Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of... That's a good start. I need to put my teeth in and then we'll start. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK police force. This is episode 69. We're still on the dive team. But first, just thanks for the downloads again. Great downloads. More people buying me a coffee. Much appreciated. Thank you. Some comments on YouTube again. So that's good. Today, we're going to talk about another dive job, but with a twist, perhaps. And without a doubt, this is the closest I ever came to dying in the police. You know, now, as we've discovered, you know, I had... You know, rifles pointed at me. I've certainly been threatened with knives on about 3 occasions and have been assaulted on, I don't know, at least 10 occasions, something like that. Thankfully, all relatively minor, and had a few, you know, close scrapes for sure. You wonder about afterwards, you know, with the what-if scenarios. But this one, there's no doubt about it, came pretty close to finishing me off, as we'll hear as we go through. So I'm still on the dive team, and we've talked about mutual aid before, where you assist other forces quite often that don't have their own resources. So the dive team is the classic in that, you know, local forces around the Met, you know, very few of them now have dive teams left because they're just too expensive to run. So you would quite often get requests in for mutual aid for the dive team to go and assist in quite often a body recovery or, you know, maybe a murder weapon that the detectives believed had been thrown into some sort of water course, you know, that's a pond, a lake, a river, whatever. So it wasn't unusual at all. We had to try and slot it in with our normal work. So it wasn't always possible, but, you know, we would always make every effort to assist, you know, because it's, as I say, it's very difficult to get those resources for the smaller sort of local forces. So on this occasion, we had a request from Kent Police down on the south east coast of the UK, and around, in fact, the Dover area, which is a very, very busy shipping lane. In fact, I think it's the busiest shipping lane in the world. You know, lots of commercial ships trundling up and down the English Channel all day long, make for a very busy place. And at Dover itself, as you may or may not be aware, lots and lots of ferry traffic. You know, it's probably the main place for people going to France from the UK and vice versa. So, you know, certainly a busy, busy place. You've got the Channel Tunnel there as well, where you can go on train, Eurostar, through to Paris. Although, bizarrely, you don't get on it at Dover, you get on it somewhere else. But there's 3 or 4 ferry services running out of Dover back and forward to France and I think possibly Holland as well there, but certainly a very busy place. Now, because of its links with the history of the UK and certainly during the Second World War, you know, that is the closest point to France. I think it's something like 20 miles or 22 miles between the UK and France there. So it's the narrowest part of the English Channel. The other end, you know, sort of Cornwall end, is more like 100 miles width. So there was an awful lot of defences there in the Second World War because that was the obvious place that if the Germans were going to invade, you know, they would come across the narrow part. Logistically, I guess it would have been easier. And because of that, there was an awful lot of wrecks. Second World War, some earlier, you know, there's a few that are earlier, some really old sort of Tudor stuff going back into, you know, like 1500 and whatever. But the vast majority is kind of Second World War stuff that was, you know, either sunk by being bombed by aircraft or torpedoes from submarines. And the UK sort of wreck diving scene is big, you know, and it's it has lots and lots of people involved. And there's lots of sort of offshoots of services from that. So there's a lot of charter boats that, you know, assist in getting those divers from the various ports out to the wrecks. So just to sort of talk through briefly how it would work on a normal sort of wreck dive, you know, you'd pay for your slot on a charter boat, and that might be between £50 and £75 for the day. And you'd normally do 2 dives during that day. And the first dive would probably be your deeper dive. And this all comes down to the bends again in terms of the orders you do the dive. So you do a deeper one first in the afternoon. You'd probably do a shallow, you know, maybe a drift dive with the tide or something. It'd be a lot shallower. And the the charter boat would take you out to the wreck, and he would have the location on his GPS, and he would have found it, located it on his echo sounder, which shows like a picture of the seabed, so he knows where the wreck is, and chances are the skipper's been there, you know, hundreds of times before anyway. They would then attempt to what they call shot the wreck. So basically they would have either a small anchor or a very heavy weight, and they would wait until they're directly over top of the wreck, and then they would drop this weight into the wreck, into the wreckage itself. And it would be attached to a long rope to the surface, and that would then in turn be attached to a large buoy and probably a smaller buoy from that. And then it was a question of waiting. Now, you remember we talked in the Thames that you can only dive during slack water, when the water, when the tide isn't running. The tides are particularly strong off of Dover, and again on a spring tide, a big tide, you could get, you know, between sort of 4 and 6 knots maybe there, worst case scenario. The tides also are notoriously unreliable in terms of, you know, you get tide cards that says, well, it'll be slack water at 10 o'clock, no movement of tide, and then at 11 o'clock it'll start moving again, because you roughly get 45 minutes to an hour where you could dive without the tide flow. But if it says 10 o'clock, you know, it might be 9:30, it might be 10:30, you know, and it might only last 45 minutes, or it could last an hour and a quarter. You know, it's not an exact science. But anyway, the dive boat that's taken out our would-be diver would look to arrive, you know, out across the wreck maybe 2 hours before slack water. He'd put his shot in, so that heavy weight with the rope. And then you can see from the flow of water across the buoy on the surface how much tide is flowing. And then basically the dive boat hangs around. And then after an hour or so, you know, that tide eases off or virtually stops. And certainly as it's easing off, he'll be putting his divers in right on top of that buoy. And they'll use that rope, that shot line down to pull themselves, well, to sort of descend, but use that rope as a guide to get themselves onto the wreck. They then have their half an hour, 45 minute dive on the wreck, and when they're done, in an ideal world, they'll return to that shot line and come up it. But that's not always possible, depending on tide and how big the wreck is. So they might release an inflatable buoy from the bottom of the seabed that then goes up to the surface on a long piece of line, effectively, that's attached to almost like a big fishing reel. So you let that out. That goes to the surface. That tells the dive skipper, because he sees that buoy pop up near the boat, he knows a diver's going to come up. And then you slowly ascend whilst reeling in the sort of spare line on your big fishing reel. You've got it in its hands, that in your hands. That's how it kind of normally works on a standard wreck dive, you know. So we had a slightly different scenario. Unfortunately, every now and then, I can't give you figures, but, you know, maybe 2 or 3 divers in the UK a year die on wrecks, because there is a lot of hazards. You know, they're deep, they might get the bends, they might have miscalculated their air, they could get trapped. Now, that's highly likely, because, you know, wrecks by their very nature, especially if they've been hit by a torpedo, which has splayed out, you know, all these thousands of tons of metal in different directions from an explosion, it creates all sorts of jagged edges, and there's masts and there's rigging and line. On top of that, you get something called ghost fishing, so you can get a series of nets or lobster pots or something like that have been dropped by fishermen but have ultimately been lost because they've snagged on the wreck. But of course they're still on the wreck, so that provides all sorts of hazards to a diver. So there's definitely risks with wreck diving, you know, in the sport world. And as I say, unfortunately every year invariably there are fatalities. So what had happened in Kent on this particular year was a diver had gone down. In fact, I don't think he'd made it off the surface. He got in at the surface, which is quite a high stressful situation, because if you're a little bit nervous about the dive, that would be the time perhaps your heart is pumping a bit. And witnesses reported seeing him kind of clutching his chest, suggesting he was perhaps having some sort of a, you know, cardiac type scenario, you know, heart attack. He then disappeared from the surface, and they weren't able to find him or recover him. So we were asked by Kent to go and have a look on this wreck to see if his body, and this is like 2 or 3 days later now, whether his body had actually, you know, turned up on this wreck. Now, we thought it pretty unlikely, because I've already said the tides are very, very strong there. So if he didn't end up in the wreck or right beside it, there was every chance that if he made it to the bottom, and that's all down to the buoyancy in your suit and things, that the tides would just kind of trundle him around back and forward, And once he's off that wreck, once you've lost that reference point, you know, you've got pretty much no hope of ever finding him, because he'll have enough weight in his suit and his cylinders and the lead around his waist that he's going to stay on the bottom, and probably will never come up, although that's not a given because of the decomposition process. But anyway, we were requested to go and search this wreck for him. So we said, yeah, sure. We arranged with a local dive skipper to charter the, or I think Kent Police would have chartered, you know, this dive skipper to take us out on this wreck to search for him. The problem is, we've always talked about it, police divers, you know, don't have like free swimming ability. They're always attached to a line. If you're on scuba, then you would definitely be attached to a rope. And invariably, most of the time for safety, our diving was done with this surface supply that we've talked about before that has an airline coming down to the diver, and that's what the diver breathes off. Again, we've discussed before, you have a set of cylinders on your back, but they're for emergencies. You know, you don't breathe off them as the norm. And also at depth, you have very limited time with them. In a canal, I might get an hour out of those cylinders on my back. On this particular wreck, which was 26 meters deep, so you're talking probably 75, you know, 80, 90 feet deep, you know, because it does fluctuate a little bit with tides and also depth. I might have only, especially if I was breathing hard under stress, I might have only got 5 or 10 minutes out of those cylinders on my back. So your sort of emergency time is very limited. And the other thing is, because you've got a line attached to you, the dive boat can't drop you off and then you know, swim around freely and then you return to the surface at will. He has to maintain his position over the wreck. Now, for huge, you know, like ships that go out to the Aberdeen oil fields and things, that's no problem. They have all these position sensors and propellers around the ship that hold it against the tide and effectively anchor it in the same position. It doesn't move. But for your average dive boat, they won't have that system. So the only option open to the skipper, which is what he did this time, was to put down a series of anchors either side of the wreck and then try and, you know, slacken off one line and tighten another until he was basically sitting over top of the wreck but was held in place by an anchor out either side of the wreck. It's not ideal, but it's kind of the best he could do. And, you know, we knew that that was how, you know, it would work for us. So we went out and it was about 45 minutes, I suppose, maybe an hour from the marina. So not that far off the actual sort of Dover Harbour to the wreck itself. I think it was a Second World War wreck from memory. And we'd been told that divers had been out on it, obviously, that couple of days before when this guy had disappeared. And the ones that were already in the water had reported about 3 meters visibility. So we were really hoping that we would actually be able to see something, because it would make our jobs a lot easier. A local diver explained this wreck to us, which is helpful. And if the dive skipper could manage to get his shot line from you know, the boat down to the wreck into the stern, we knew the layout quite well. We'd been told that it was a series of cargo holds, 4 cargo holds, which are very large. You know, they're probably 20 or 30 meters across, and maybe a similar length, you know, maybe 30 or maybe even 50 meters sort of long, because these would have had, you know, thousands and thousands of tons of whatever in it, whether it was grain or, you know, ammunition or whatever it was carrying in those holds. And I think there was 4 holds to search. So we're talking about a big ship here. And we're also told that if you made it to the bow has kind of disintegrated and basically become shingle and beach, you know. So once you get to that point, you know that you've reached the end of the wreck. So we rigged it up, myself and a colleague, with the 2 divers that were going to go down. And, you know, we were relatively happy with the situation. We'd both done wreck diving before privately. And at that point, I'd done maybe, you know, 100 wreck dives or something like that. So had a bit of experience for sure. And the guy I was with was a very, very experienced police diver, you know, a good friend of mine. And he'd certainly done some wreck dives as well. Very competent diver. So I was feeling, you know, pretty happy about the situation, although it was very different from our normal dives, you know. Certainly at work. So the skipper managed to position himself brilliantly. Really good skipper over top of the wreck. No mean feat, to be honest with you. So he did that. And then the shot line went in as well, ideally straight into the stern. So we knew where we were. As I say, 26 meters down. And it takes you a couple of minutes or so to get from the surface as you drop down that line. And normally you just have your hand your thumb and forefinger just loosely around that shot line and you slide down into the depths. Straight away, unfortunately, we realised there was very little visibility, and these things change virtually by the hour, you know, so although we'd hoped we might have some, it looked like we were going to have very, very little, maybe a metre at best, and at times none at all. So as the tide had started to ease, we dropped in and we knew we had, you know, our kind of 45 minutes, maybe an hour if we were lucky, to search this wreck. And I'm afraid we weren't holding out a lot of hope. So we dropped down the shot line a couple of minutes and then you pretty much slam into the wreck. You know, there's kind of, you don't get a lot of warning with no visibility that's coming up. And we landed on a flat piece, but we were able to identify that it was probably the stern, and certainly the skipper was fairly confident he'd got that heavy weight and line into the stern. So myself and my colleague, we were attached by a buddy line to each other. So we had a 5 meter line between us to give us a little bit of distance to search, but equally so we weren't going to lose each other. And then, of course, we both had our surface supply line supplying our air that went up to the surface back onto the dive boat where our attendants were. We had comms. They weren't brilliant. And certainly in those depths, you know, they're unreliable to say the least. But don't forget, we have the backup of using rope signals to come up with, you know, different messages. So we started our search and we found our way to the first hold. And, you know, this hold was deep. We dropped into that first hold and I was aware that we dropped for, you know, another 3 or 4 meters. So we were down to about 26 meters at this point before we hit the bottom of the hold. And then we kind of spread ourselves out to the distance of our 5 meter buddy line and began our sort of two-handed sweeping across the floor searching that hold in case the diver had ended up in there. And we searched, luckily, I mean, the holds are kind of square or oblong, so we were able to use that to our advantage and carry out a systematic search that we were pretty happy with once we finished that hold. So then we ascended kind of 2 or 3 meters and were able to get out of that hold and into the next one. And this is how it continued on. So we covered the four holds and we'd probably done about half an hour of diving, had found nothing, had had no luck. And then we continued on our way towards what we thought was the bow. And sure enough, that's what it turned out to be. Because a little while after that, it seemed that the bow kind of broke up and disappeared. And sure enough, here was the shingle that we'd been told about, that if you hit the shingle, that's basically the end of the wreck. You know, it kind of is broken up and that's it. So we both looked at each other, kind of recognised what we were seeing and signalled with our fingers, you know, for an about turn and to head back to where we'd come from. The added complication is we'd also clipped off a what you call a distance line to the bottom of the shot, because we really needed to find our way back to that shot. There was no option for us putting up our own little inflatable buoys, which are called DSMBs, from the bottom and then free ascending like you would if you're a sport diver. We had to find our way back to that shot line to then safely get to the surface. So we made our way back to the bottom of the shot line. So now it's getting quite complicated. We've got the two lines to the surface, one off of each of us. We've got a buddy line between us, and I've also got a great big, effectively, it looks like a fishing reel, but it's a huge plastic reel that sort of fits in your hand. There is a distance line that's clipped off to the bottom of the shot so that it follows us, and then we can follow it back to the bottom of the shot line. So, excuse me, there's quite a lot of potential here for entanglement. And every now and then, you know, you would get a bit around your leg or around your colleague or whatever, and we'd have to just stop and sort that out. But it, you know, it didn't really phase us, and there was no dramas doing that. We kind of expected it and just dealt with it when it happened. So yeah, turned around, made our way back and got to the bottom of the shot line. Now, one of the things that happened when we were at the bottom of the shot line, we were only about 35 minutes into our dive, something like that, of an expected maybe 45 minutes. The tide had turned. So when we first got in, the tide was just flowing still, but easing off, which is the perfect time to get in for a wreck dive, knowing that we've now got, like, you know, 45 minutes to an hour of slack water. But 35 minutes in, the tide had turned. It was very obvious. You could feel immediately that not only had it turned, but it was starting to flow, and actually quite quickly starting to flow. And again, this is what I said, the tides, you know, are really quite unpredictable in what they're going to do. You know, they're a law unto themselves. So anyway, we were happy that we'd carried out a search to the best of our ability. It wasn't perfect. And like I say, we weren't expecting to find his body, if I'm honest. But you know, we'd done the best we could. So we signalled with a thumbs up that we were going to ascend up the shot line back to the boat. And at this point, you know, it had gone reasonably well and we were quite happy. So we very slowly came up the shot line because we want to avoid the bends, as we've talked about many times. And the visibility didn't change. We still had about a metre or so. Myself and my colleague had a little bit of communication between ourselves as well. But it's very, you know, sort of broken and crackled, and the tide can make quite a noise if it starts roaring along. So you really have to kind of push the speaker into your ear, you know, where your headphone is, to actually hear what they're saying. Sometimes in that scenario, it's actually easier if you're close to the diver to put your mouth, bearing in mind we had full face masks on, to put your mouth right up next to their ear and shout in your mask. And actually that can be heard sometimes easier through the water. So we continued to ascend up the shot line slowly, you know, going at the rate that we had. Now, you have a dive computer on that can give you a steer as to the rate you're ascending at. And some people say that, oh, you know, you come up at the same speed as your bubbles that you've just exhaled. And that way, as long as you don't go faster than those bubbles, that's a good speed. But generally, I would use my kind of dive computer, which would give me a pretty good idea on like a progress bar, if you like, that tells you your ascent rate. And we obviously wanted to stay within the safe level so we didn't cause any problems. And we got to about, I suppose, 5 meters deep. So we're almost at the surface. And two things had happened now. The tide had increased significantly. So the shot line that we were holding on, you know, barely having to hold onto on the way down because there was no tide flow, we were now having to use a hand and really sort of grip hold of that line and hold on quite tightly because the tide was wanting to wash us off that, you know, that shot line. And the other thing was, when we got in the water, it had been quite calm. There was very little sort of waves on the surface, which makes life easier. But now at 5 meters deep and with the added light from the surface, we could see that there was a bit of swell running on the surface, maybe, you know, a meter or something like that, which doesn't sound much, but that means that if you're sitting there at 5 meters, 1 minute you're at kind of 5, 6, maybe 8 meters, and the next minute you might be at 3 or 4 meters deep. So we were getting washed up and down quite a bit. And we'd stopped, which we'd agreed to do, and in fact we needed to put in a stop prior to coming to the surface again to sort of complete any decompression that we had, a decompression penalty as they call it, to ensure that we didn't get the bends. So we stopped and that was fine. And then when we went to move off, we carried out, you know, the amount of minutes we needed to have at that stop, which I think was like 5 minutes or something. And when we came to actually come to the surface, my colleague sort of stopped, didn't move, and I could see he was having a bit of difficulty. So I was kind of looking at him and trying to look down at his feet to figure out what was going on. And I could see he had hold of his umbilical line and he was pulling quite hard on his umbilical line. And also, I was aware that that umbilical line should be going straight from the diver to the surface, to the boat. But it wasn't. It was going straight down to the shot line, the base of the shot line. Or that's where it disappeared from our view because of the lack of visibility. So, of course, you know, it was immediate obvious that he probably was snagged either on the bottom of the shot line, which was the best case scenario, or even worse, on the wreck itself. So he tried several times to sort of pull himself free and couldn't. And he communicated to me that he was snagged and I could see what was going on. And then we tried to communicate with the surface to give us some more slack line, because the thinking was that if we had a wrap around something, the wreck, the shot line, whatever it was, they could just release out more, you know, umbilical from the surface, and we would then pull that slack up. And as we, you know, sort of pulled the slack, we would be able to then surface. So at least we could get on the boat, and if needs be, we could then detach our airlines once we were safely on the boat, and they could then pull them through. Or to be honest with you, if the line ended up snagged permanently on the wreck, I didn't really care. You know, I just wanted to be back on that boat and safe, obviously. But the problem was the comms were rubbish. And they couldn't really understand us. And in fact, I think about this time, they pretty much stopped working. So we weren't able to really communicate with them to give us, you know, more slack line. Now, we tried using the rope signals, but because the line was going straight down to the wreck, you know, pulling on that line wasn't actually getting through to our attendants on the boat. So we were struggling a bit to communicate. We were trying to discuss amongst ourselves by shouting in each other's ears what we were going to do. Now, it's extremely difficult to detach these lines underwater. They're under 300 bars of pressure, and on the surface, they're quite difficult and cumbersome to actually attach and detach from the diver. But under the water, when you're trying to hang on to a shot line and that the tide is trying to wash you away on, and you've got, you know, a meter swell running, so you're getting washed up and down, it really is quite difficult. So we didn't think that was an option. Now, we could have maybe cut through that line, but that line, by its very nature, is armored, you know, and we'd practiced before on the surface with our dive knives cutting through spare bits of this line to see how possible it was. And on paper, it was doable, but very difficult again, because you can imagine if you're soaring in one place with your knife, which was sort of had a serrated edge on one side, to try and keep that in the same place, you know, you could form a loop in the line and try and cut through in the same place. But getting washed about and trying to hang on and do it with one hand while the waves are pushing you up and down, really quite difficult. And you had to be able to keep in the same place and soar for, you know, a good 5 minutes to actually get through. So anyway, we very quickly had a discussion. And although it went against quite a few of the rules, the situation was becoming a little bit desperate now. So we decided we would go back down to the wreck and try and release the line if it was easy. But don't forget, we couldn't come off our shot line. We couldn't afford to be washed away off this shot line. So we had to. Now, this is a very bad practice in terms of diving, because one thing you don't want to do is what they call a sawtooth profile in diving, which is where you go up and down a lot. You need to go down to the bottom, you stay on the bottom, and then you come up. You know, what you don't do is go down to the bottom, come up, go back down again, come back up. You know, that's very bad practice. But we were running out of options a little bit, so it was decided we would go back down. And don't forget, this was 26 meters deep, so this wasn't a 2 meter canal. This wasn't a, you know, a 10 meter dock. This was a lot more serious in terms of depth. So we went back down to the shot, and we were really hoping that his umbilical would have just been snagged around the bottom of the shot line, because that would have been easy to release it. The attendants on the surface would have taken up the slack, and that would have been it, job done. Unfortunately, we got back down on the bottom to 26 meters to find that not only was his umbilical not snagged on the bottom of the shot line, when we were at the base of the shot, it was stretching away from us in the darkness straight back to the wreck. So it was almost certainly, you know, snagged around the wreck at some high point. And, you know, in slack water scenario, we might have had a chance of following it and being able to release it. But with the tide now increasing and increasing constantly and getting faster and faster, there was no way. It was all we could do to hang on to the shot line to stay in the same place. There was no way that we were going to be able to get back to that shot. So it was decided we would try and ascend again to the surface and hope that us coming back down, you know, cleared it. We were running out of options really at this point. So that's what we did. We took our time again. We slowly came back to the surface. And unfortunately, once again, we got to 3 meters. And same thing again. He was snagged. He couldn't move. It was absolutely solid. He was pulling it as hard as he could. I was trying to pull it. Well, there's only so much pull you can get when you're floating and you're trying to hang on to a shot line. And now there's like, you know, a knot of tide, maybe two knots of tide that's trying to wash us away as well. So he was, we both had a good yank on this line and could not clear it at all. So I shouted to his ear, the only option we've got is that I will try and detach him from his airline, although I knew it was going to be difficult. And he would have to switch over to his emergency air on his back. Now, the good thing is we were only at about 3 meters, so that air would last for a long time. The problem is the moment I disconnect that umbilical, he now can't breathe and he will run out of air almost immediately. He only has a couple of seconds to flick a switch on the side of his sort of shoulder, which then flicks you on to your emergency air on your back. And of course, you're really hoping that that switch is going to work. We operated them all the time to test them, you know, and they always did. But in the back of your mind was like, when I flick that switch, I need it to work. So that's what we did. And I basically had to sort of wrap my legs around him and the shot line. And don't forget, we're now bouncing up and down in the swell, which has got worse at this point. It's probably about a meter and a half swell. So at the bottom of the trough, when the swell passed, our heads were, you know, a foot from the surface. I think very occasionally we were actually breaking the surface with our heads, but the next minute we'd be 3 or 4 meters deep as we were sort of pulled back down. And the tide is pushing against us. So I had my legs wrapped around him, and my arm around the shot, and it was even more difficult. I just couldn't see I was going to be able to detach this umbilical, because what you have to do is you have to first of all unscrew a collar, and then you have to push the umbilical, the sort of valve, against itself before you then slide another collar up and then detach it. But this is all under 300 bar pressure, so very, very difficult. Anyway, two or three attempts, I managed to release it, and I was so relieved, and I just, you know, threw it away, gave him the thumbs up. I can't remember I did or whether he did, but flicked the switch onto his emergency line, emergency air on his back, and he gave me, you know, the thumbs up. He was breathing. That was great. So that's fantastic. I was like, job done. We're happy days. You know, we're saved. Hurrah. You know, back for tier medals. So he released the shot line and started, came to the surface and started swimming over for the boat. I then likewise went to follow. We detached the buddy line from between us as well at this point, because it was easier to swim on a surface when you weren't attached to each other. So I wasn't attached to him. I went to come up the rest of the shot line to join him on the boat, and I could see, you know, when I was almost breaking the surface, well, I must have just broken the surface, because I could see that he made it to the boat. To my horror, when I went to follow him up to the surface, my umbilical was doing exactly the same thing, and this was the first time that we'd realized, or I'd realized, that I was also snagged on the wreck. And I tried as I might, like my colleague had, and I could not release my line. So I was still snagged on the wreck. So this was an even worse situation. I had no option of going back down again. I 100% couldn't do that, because that would have been the bends guaranteed, and quite serious as well, because I'd have been up and down twice. You cannot detach your own line. It's impossible. It's underneath your armpit. So, you know, and like I've already described the difficulty of somebody else doing it for you, I couldn't release it. The other nightmare was that because I had no idea I was, you know, I was also snagged, I'd now let go of the shot line thinking that I was about to swim to the boat. But the nightmare scenario was I was now being washed away by the tide. I'd not made it to the surface quite. Or I had in maybe, you know, at the bottom of the swells, because now we're talking maybe 2 meter swells. It continued to build the sea state. So I was just breaking the surface at the bottom, but I couldn't get back to the boat. And even worse, because I'd let go of the shot line, which is what was keeping me on the surface, the tide was pushing very hard against me. But don't forget, my umbilical was snagged on the wreck. So effectively, it wanted to kind of wash me to the sort of, so that my umbilical was as tight as it went, and therefore that would have made me leave the surface and ultimately arrive back on the bottom. That's what the tide was trying to do. So I was finning like crazy to try and keep on the surface, giving it everything I could. And don't forget, we'd already done like a, at this point, 45 minute dive, so I was pretty tired. But now trying to keep myself buoyant, I was trying to put air in my dry suit to keep me on the surface, but it wasn't working. I was getting dragged under, and I was really trying to think fast. I had a few seconds to make up my mind what I was going to do, because if I got washed back down to the bottom, I'd never have released myself. I'd have probably had to ditch my kit and ended up heading for the surface, you know, on a breath hold or something. But I'd have been bent to buggery, basically, because I'd have been up and down two or three times. There was no good scenarios. I only had one thing I could do. And if this didn't work, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do, because it's very difficult to actually then completely wriggle out of all your kit and ditch your cylinders and all that on the surface. So that wasn't something I could do easily. If it had been slack water, I probably could have done that. Probably could have wriggled out my kit, ditched my cylinders, and then, you know, ripped my mask off and swam to the surface and gone, because I wasn't very deep. But while I was trying to do that and keep myself up, I would have been continually pushed back down by the tide and taken deeper and deeper while I was trying to bin my kit. So it would have been incredibly difficult. The only thing I came up with was that when I broke surface very briefly, my sergeant was standing on the corner of the boat and he was screaming at me to sort of throw him a line. Well, the only line I had was my buddy line, which was that 5 meter line. I was very close to the boat. I wasn't sure whether I was close enough for the 5 meters. And also I had to successfully throw it from me in the conditions that I've described to him. And then he had to catch it. All of which was pretty unlikely, but I literally was out of choices. So as I came to the surface, The buddy line was tangled up around my legs. I managed to rip it off my legs and get it back in my hand. And then as I was sort of getting washed towards the back of the boat, I had to time it with the bottom of the swell so that now the boat was kind of 2 meters above me and I was in the bottom of the trough and had just broken the surface. I threw the buddy line at my sergeant. And amazingly, 100% he saved my life that day. He caught it. And I was screaming at him to take a turn on the boat, which basically meant, you know, put a couple of turns of that rope around the back cleat on the dive boat. And that would at least hold me on the surface so that I could relax and we could figure out what we were going to do. But it would buy me some time. And thankfully, that's what he managed to do. He understood how he heard it through my mask and the rising wind and the 2 meter swell, you know, everything going on. He managed to get a couple of turns around that boat, which held me on the surface. And then, amazingly, once my colleague had got on the boat, he was able to explain what was happening. So they were releasing a lot of slack on my umbilical, which enabled to give me just enough slack to reach the back of the boat. And then I climbed onto there's a dive lift on the back of the boat, which basically lowers into the water by 2 meters. You stand on it, they press a button, and then it raises you up to the level of the deck and you're able to step off. And I was able to get on the back of the boat. But it was a very, very close run thing. They detached my umbilical then, threw it back in the water, and they were then able to pull it free from whatever snag it was. But I basically collapsed into the back of the boat, you know, puffing like you wouldn't believe. Felt like I was going to have a heart attack. I was sort of breathing so hard. Got my mask off and my kit and then just sort of lay there for a second, pretty much kissing the deck, you know. And my colleague came over who had been with me, you know, and sort of patted me on the back, and we kind of looked at each other and realized just how close we'd come. And yeah, it was a very, very well, it wasn't at the time a scary moment, but certainly on the way back. So basically the boat then came back into the port, as you'd expect. We got back into our van and drove back to London. Now, normally on our vans, you know, there was a lot of banter and there'd always be some mickey taking and what have you while we sort of chundled back to the base. But on this day, everyone realised how close we'd come, and we just sat there in silence, just sort of lost in our own thoughts, just thinking about just how close we came. And yeah, it was scary to look back on it even now, because, you know, came pretty close. As I say, I don't know if he hadn't caught that line, I don't really know what the options were for me. I just don't think I'd have got out of that kit before I'd have been pushed back down onto the bottom, and then it would have been, you know, mask off and tried to get out. It would have been horrendous. Yeah, so there we go, a little bit of a longer one today because I wasn't going to stop it at the end there while I was in full flow. Hope you found that interesting, and next week we'll move on to something else. But certainly in the podcast, my time in the Met is coming to an end now, so we've probably only got 2 or 3 more episodes maybe before I'm on the move to another force again, and we'll talk about that next week. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks very much. Speak to you soon. Cheers. Bye.